Welcome, this is James Corbett. It's the 16th of January, 2013 here in Japan. It is still the 15th in the United States, where I'm joined on the line tonight by Grant F. Smith, the Research Director of IRMEP. That's the Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy, which is available at IRMEP.org. He's been on the program before on Corbett Report Radio. So Grant, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here, James. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I wanted to have you on today to talk about an interesting new press release that you have up there posted at the top of IRMEP.org right now. IRS petitioned to not restore ZOA tax-exempt status. And I want to talk about this. It's an interesting history going on here. But before we get into the tax-exempt status of the ZOA, I suppose we should actually talk about what the ZOA is. Of course, this is the Zionist Organization of America. And, well, it's an interesting organization. But let's get into some of the who, what, where, whens, and whys of the ZOA, how it came about, who put it together, and why it was formed.
Sure, absolutely. I guess the most interesting part about the history of the Zionist Organization of America is that if you believe its self-image statements, it goes all the way back to the first Zionist Convention of 1897, in which it's taking Herzl's vision of forming a Jewish state in Palestine and trying to take actions to make that happen. But if you actually go back in classic newspaper archives and go through the clippings, you don't really see it appearing on the scene until the 1920s, where it begins making announcements. The important thing about the ZOA, I think, for people who even wonder why we want to talk about it today, is that it's certainly at the extreme ends of the Israel lobbying sort of matrix. They're at the forefront of the anti-Hegel campaign right now, where they're vociferously issuing press releases and statements opposing his candidacy to be the next Secretary of Defense. And they've never made it, they've never been shy about saying that they're pro-settlement, pro-annexation of conquered and occupied territories. And so, again, within sort of, you know, the Rubik's Cube, and that's the way we like to think of it, the Rubik's Cube of organizations, they're sort of out there in terms of really giving AIPAC and some of the others a run for their money, competing against them and lobbying for Congress, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you asked about the history of the organization, and I think the most important thing to know is that it's almost, you can say that it's almost sort of a quasi-governmental organization. My organization in researching ZOA a couple of years ago asked the IRS for its articles of incorporation and the reason why they gave them tax-exempt status, and they couldn't come up with one, saying they destroyed all their documents before 1946. And so we started doing some legal research and found out that they actually came into being in 1920 when the New York State Legislature issued Special Law 205 of April 14, 1920, bringing them into being as a corporation. And so what we think is that this sort of quasi-governmental status gave it a heightened sort of presence in the eyes of the IRS, which didn't do any particular due diligence into its activities and simply granted them status. And they had a lot of status in terms of people who were affiliated with them. They had Justice Louis Brandeis, Rabbi Abba Hillel Silver, Stephen Weiss. These are giants in terms of sort of the Zionist movement in putting together all sorts of petitions, going to state legislatures where ZOA members effectively lobbied for many state legislatures. This is before 1948, lobbied them for resolutions on creating a Jewish state in Palestine. Now, this was a new trick back then. Today, you'll see Israel lobbying organizations and state chapters of AIPAC lobbying for divestment of state pensions from companies that do business in ways they feel harm Israel's interests. But this was fairly new back before the 1940s, or between 1920 and 1940, when the ZOA was coming into being and beginning to sort of muster its power. And what I found in our research is that the combination of its huge membership, you know, just all the way across the country, and prominent leaders made it essentially untouchable. It was kind of too big to fail, beyond good and evil, kind of like a Goldman Sachs or an AIG today, just a giant, powerful organization that really struck fear into the heart of regulators and legislators alike.
So it played a role similar to what AIPAC plays in today's politics then?
Well, today you have AIPAC being sort of the lead organization. You know, today the ZOA has about $3 million in revenue per year. AIPAC has about $70 million. ZOA claims about 15,000 members. AIPAC claims 50 to 100,000, depending on, you know, which press release you read. So ZOA's purpose was really facilitating the creation of a state in Palestine, whereas AIPAC kind of took over and became the lead lobbying organization for maintaining preferential treatment. But what we focus on in a new Washington Report on Middle East Affairs article that was chartered for January, February, a special report on the ZOA, we focus in on some of the little-known links that it had to helping create the state, specifically its ties to conventional weapons smuggling and later ties to nuclear smuggling, and also the recently declassified Justice Department files about a serious effort to make the Zionist Organization of America register as a foreign agent of Israel.
That's right, and that's all fascinating. I want to get into that, but one point before we move on. So the Zionist Organization of America was formed specifically as the American branch of the World Zionist Organization, or is it a separate agency into and of itself?
Well, okay, so this gets into the controversy. The Justice Department, after an extensive review in the 1940s, found that because it was answerable to the WZO, the World Zionist Organization, which is headquartered in Jerusalem, because it had to abide by WZO bylaws, because it had to send delegates and report to the WZO and also engage in various unspecified activities the WZO might want, the Justice Department's opinion expressed in six separate orders to the organization to register as the foreign agent of the WZO, their opinion, and well-founded in the documents that we've reviewed, was that it was in fact a subsidiary of the World Zionist Organization. And that's very important because, as you know, and as we've discussed on a previous program, Americans are supposed to be protected by a law called the 1938 Foreign Agents Registration Act, where any giant lobbying organization or even small, you know, public relations efforts conducted on the basis or on the behalf of any foreign agents are supposed to be fully public in terms of their finances and their program. And the WZO, while clearly directing ZOA, what we see is that the ZOA refused to comply with any of those orders, setting up a huge battle between the Justice Department and ZOA.
That's right. Let's talk about some of the smuggling that you talked about earlier. We touched on this in our previous conversation, talking about the nuclear smuggling, but you mentioned conventional weapons smuggling before that point.
Right.
Let's talk about some of that history.
So this is Rudolf Sonnenborn, okay? And the Sonnenborn Institute, which he created, and he was a major ZOA leader, took place during a trip by David Ben-Gurion, who was the executive director of something called a sort of a government in waiting called the Jewish Agency. He met with Sonnenborn in his elegant New York apartment with a number of extremely prominent American leaders of the Zionist movement, rumored to be Henry Morgenthau Jr. and many other people, to put together the necessary finance and begin shipping war material and particular weapons through various smuggling fronts. In addition to the Sonnenborn Institute, there was MarTech, Materials for Palestine, Service Airways. And so this nucleus formed sort of the headquarters for a number of different smuggling organizations that quickly became, well, they got on the radar of the FBI relatively quickly. Their disregard to public safety was legion. They were shipping explosives that they purchased from the War Assets Administration, which was decommissioning World War II surplus and selling it off for productive uses, but certainly not to be shipped overseas to war zones. Taking that, putting it in boxes labeled machinery or clothing, and shipping it from New York piers off to Palestine. And so they were stuffing boilers full of guns and ammunition, all in violation of the Arms Export Control Act, all in violation of the Neutrality Act. And what you see, again, are incidents that come up in the newspaper record and in FBI files. There's a 7,000-page archive at the National Archives that's available that has photos and extreme detail of all of the smuggling organizations. They quickly became, because they're all interlinked, they're an easy target for law enforcement. Boxes falling out of cargo nets onto the piers of New York, and suddenly authorities see that what's going on here, they're smuggling weapons, they're smuggling ammunition. And so the FBI relatively quickly became involved in seeing who was behind this smuggling network, and relatively quickly identified Sonnenborn, identified the Jewish Agency, identified this archipelago of front organizations that was behind the smuggling. There's an overlap then between their investigation of the smuggling and the Justice Department's investigation of some of the organizations associated with the smuggling. Now, very few people went to jail over this. Only a handful of people were ever indicted, even though hundreds were directly identified by the FBI. All of the high-profile New York lawyers and people affiliated with these, again, too big to fail organizations, mysteriously were able to lobby through people close to the president to make sure that they wouldn't be indicted. But a handful of small, lower-level people were indicted. If you Google, in fact, ZOA agent registration, you can see some of the documents where, in pursuit of the smuggling organizations, you see them begin to center in on the WZO and the Zionist Organization of America. So the FBI became aware of the smuggling ties between these ostensibly legitimate organization and these underground front companies. And they also identified just a growing wave of anti-Arab propaganda that was being emitted by these same organizations. And so the natural question was, well, in whose benefit is all of that anti-Arab propaganda? And there was a real sense of urgency at the Justice Department to kind of get the people behind the curtain out into the front and center and get them registered as agents of a foreign state. In fact, in March of 1948, a Justice Department staffer wrote an internal memo saying, quote, "If ZOA is to be exempt from registration," meaning foreign agent registration, "the Justice Department might as well forget its entire campaign," unquote. Campaign meaning the campaign to actually enforce the open registration of people acting on behalf of foreign agents. So what we have in the story of these newly released Justice Department files about the Zionist Organization of America is that the Attorney General basically stabbed his career staffers in the back. In 1948, they heard from above that in spite of their 7 attempts to get this organization to register as an Israeli foreign agent, that order was not being taken seriously by the people they were targeting, and they found out why. It was because the Attorney General, without any statutory right to do so, basically told the ZOA officials that they would not be pursued for past activities or forced to register. So he left his staff hanging with all of these foreign agent registration orders. And you see in the file that was declassified and released, and you mentioned the press release we put out about that, of the FARA section chief politely asking the Zionist Organization of America executives if they felt it was, you know, time to register. You know, and these memos are dated 1960, so, you know, 12 years after the original effort, they're politely asking the ZOA whether they would like to register. And there was a complete abdication of enforcement of a law really designed to protect Americans. And this had major consequences, which we get into when we talk about the next stage of the smuggling, which became nuclear smuggling.
And just to refresh people's memories about ZOA's involvement in that nuclear smuggling, talk about some of the characters who were involved in that.
Right. So, presumably emboldened, you have two other ZOA officials. One of them is called Zalman Shapiro, president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Zionist Organization of America. The other is Ivan Novick, who was later the national president of the Zionist Organization of America, teaming up with a smuggler by the name of David Lowenthal, who had extensive ties with Israeli intelligence, and forming a severely undercapitalized nuclear processing facility in 1959. What they were doing is putting together an organization that was in line to mine the most precious material on Earth at that point, which was highly enriched uranium, which the Israelis needed for their nuclear weapons program. And so in tight coordination with Israeli intelligence, NUMEC bought, for what we believe was $500, an old steel plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania, leveraged Zalman Shapiro's ties to get Navy fuel contracts to produce fuel for nuclear submarines. It quickly established this weird joint venture. So here you have this startup company, you know, it's 3 years old, and suddenly it's in a joint venture with an Israeli entity, the Israeli Atomic Energy Commission. And curiously enough, this joint venture requires shipping irradiators and weather stations powered by small amounts of plutonium to the Israelis, you know, sealed containers. And so, you know, it just happens to require shipping these from, you know, the ports of New York on Zim ships. And as it turns out, later investigation, the IAEC, the Israeli Atomic Energy Commission, NUMEC's joint venture, was simply a front for the Israeli nuclear weapons development program. And anyone who wants to look up NUMEC on the internet can see FBI affidavits of people who actually were present witnessing Zalman Shapiro, the, you know, again, ZOA Pittsburgh chapter president, instructing his plant employees and other unknown individuals to stuff U-235 into equipment for shipment to Israel. A totally inappropriate way to ship any nuclear material. But oddly enough, you know, very reminiscent of the conventional smuggling. So it's my conclusion based on looking at all of the available law enforcement documents that the DOJ's, the Justice Department's inability to enforce the Foreign Agents Registration Act and really crack down on ZOA people involved in conventional smuggling sort of created this sense of impunity and that they would get away with this as well. And again, kind of like the conventional smuggling, it's extremely well documented in terms of the files that have been released. The FBI files are all out. But there's quite a bit of additional information which has not yet been released. It goes all the way from LBJ to the Carter administration, high-level documents about what to do with the NUMEC crisis. But, you know, the ZOA's sort of involvement in this sort of activity wasn't limited to weapons. In the Carter administration, Viktor Ostrovsky, a dissident Mossad agent who left the agency and told all in a couple of books, also mentions the fact that during operations to discredit the Arabs in diplomatic circles around the UN, during the Carter administration, that they wiretapped Andrew Young, having prohibited meetings with the PLO, took tapes of that, transferred it to the Israelis, who decided that even at the cost of burning their operations, they would diffuse this through the press in the United States. And there's Ivan Novik, you know, former NUMEC Apollo Industries executives, helping get that information out that the Mossad wanted out so badly. So you've got this sort of extreme sense within the ZOA and some of its operatives in the early years that their cause was so just that and their organization so untouchable that they would be allowed to that no crime, as long as it was for Israel, would be punished by the U.S. basically.
Well, then let's move this conversation up towards the present. And as we've mentioned a couple times now, you do have a press release up on ermep.org right now. IRS petition to not restore ZOA tax exempt status as Justice Department tapped for foreign agent file. And that says, in part, quote, the IRS received a 13909 petition from ERMEP's Center for Policy and Law Enforcement urging it not to restore the tax exempt status of the Zionist Organization of America. Let's talk about that tax exempt status and basically what it is that you're petitioning for here.
Right. So what we're seeing here is something interesting. You know, Al Capone was not brought down for, you know, the horrendous act of smuggling Canadian whiskey into Chicago. He was brought down by violating, you know, tax code. And what we're seeing here is that the Zionist Organization of America has suddenly gotten itself into a huge mess. Now, I already mentioned that it's kind of a shadow of its former self. It's still at the forefront, the extreme forefront, in terms of lobbying for some of the most harmful U.S. policies imaginable. But an important change occurred in 2008 in IRS regulations concerning nonprofit organizations with tax exempt status filing their returns. They became much more strict. You had to disclose a lot more, particularly about money that was moving overseas. It wouldn't be enough anymore to tell the IRS, like AIPAC and other organizations did, oh, we're sending money over to the Middle East and North Africa. No, you actually had to say, no, we're sending this to our Jerusalem office subsidiary, which we're also supporting with $2 million a year, and Dan Senior's sister is running it while he's simultaneously lobbying. Yeah, I mean, you had to disclose a lot more on the 2008 Form 990. And so for the past 3 years, the Zionist Organization of America didn't file any returns. And just like other organizations that don't file returns, after 3 years, the IRS revokes your tax-exempt status. So the ZOA is no longer a charity. And there are possibly other reasons it lost its tax-exempt status. You can only be called a tax-exempt charity in the U.S. if you have broad public support. But if you review the previous 3 years' tax returns of the ZOA, what you see is that big donors like Sheldon Adelson and others were providing, you know, the top 10 donors of the organization were basically providing 80% of total funding, which probably doesn't meet the IRS threshold for public support. And so it could be that they managed to tip themselves into foundation status and decided that they didn't want to deal with that by actually filing any more returns. So, you know, despite their questionable past, it may be that they're not going to be able to regain sort of their preferential status because of these issues. And so what we've done is called attention to the IRS in this 13909 complaint, saying basically, you know, this is an organization which, you know, pays 10% of its $3 million budget to its CEO, who's grossly overpaid. And this has been mentioned in many articles about the ZOA. 10% of the budget is spent on unspecified lobbying activities. We mentioned again, although AIPAC has tried to corral the Israel lobby ecosphere behind it as the only organization that's going to lobby Congress, the ZOA lobbies Congress and files reports that basically disclose nothing about what it's doing, and it's using tax-deductible funding to lobby. And so that may be a problem. And we've also made it clear that the IRS should consider that the ZOA doesn't have a bona fide social welfare purpose. I mean, it was always designed to create, you know, as a political movement, a nationalist movement, to create a foreign state. And it's an organization with so much historical baggage that it should be impossible for it to really regain its former status. But the only way, you know, and this, the thing that following this story, the thing that makes one much more aware of this is that the Justice Department already gave this organization a break. So what's to keep the IRS from simply letting this organization continue on its merry way? Well, all the other organizations that lose their tax-exempt status have to file a completely new application and publicly justify. You can see these applications and you can contact the IRS if you don't think they're doing the right thing. They have to publicly justify why they should get this coveted status. And again, we don't think they ever justified this to the IRS. So the idea is to show the IRS that there's public involvement and there's going to have to be some accountability in terms of this particular organization. But the real accountability is not going to come through that particular motion. It's going to come somewhere else, which I'd like to talk about if you have time.
Well, absolutely I do, because I imagine that the accountability that we're looking for probably will not come as a result of this. So where can we find that? Where can we actually get accountability for these actions?
Sure. So back in the early 1970s, the first few books about the conventional smuggling ring, the first few tell-all books began to hit American readers. One of them, called The Pledge, discussed in quite a bit of detail all of the front companies, the illegal activities, you know, the attempts to buy an aircraft carrier, the flying of B-17s, which were bought under false purposes, the creation of an airline that was flown overseas and then used to ship weapons from Czechoslovakia. All of this started coming out, and people were mad about it. And they began to contact the Justice Department, people like financial guru and gadfly Norman Dacey, saying, hey, we want to see some people arrested. We want to see them prosecuted for violating the Arms Export Control Act. We want to see some of these prominent lawyers that were never arrested be debarred and go to jail. And the Justice Department published a book report, which is also online now, saying, this looks pretty serious. And they also involved the State Department, which came back to Dacey and said, well, these laws have all changed. We don't know about the statute of limitations. Why don't you hire some lawyers at your own expense and further develop this case? And so it didn't go anywhere. And the real issue was the idea of a victimless crime. Well, you know, what standing did any American have for going to the Justice Department and saying, you know, this is wrong. these organizations and individuals who are violating all of these laws, and they continue with impunity. And the problem was they didn't have any standing. But that's not the case with the nuclear smuggling. Nuclear smuggling, in this particular case, you know, they weren't just dropping ammunition boxes on New York piers. The undercapitalization of NUMEC was so severe that it could not help but pollute two environs, two boroughs in Pennsylvania. And there are thousands of people who have either been affected in terms of radiation poisoning or poisoning from industrial chemicals, who have suffered severe trauma, whose property values have declined, who have or people have even died because of NUMEC's negligence. Its purpose as a smuggling front drove its shoestring operations. You know, you can see in press reports at the time that they even referred to themselves as completing Navy contracts with pots and pans. I mean, it was a grossly, grossly undercapitalized operation with only one purpose, to get its hands on weapons-grade uranium, ship it, and then spin it off, which it did. The operation was so shoddy, the Atomic Energy Commission basically dangled a contract to Atlantic Richfield to manage the Hanford facilities in Washington. $100 million contracts, hundreds of millions of dollars in the contracts, and said, if you acquire NUMEC and clean up NUMEC, we will give you these Hanford management contracts. And of course, Atlantic Richfield jumped on the contract, acquired NUMEC, acquired its liabilities. Shapiro cashed out and tried to get a job getting access to hydrogen bomb designs, but that's a whole different story. But thousands of people were damaged and actually have standing to go after the true perpetrators of the NUMEC crisis. And many of them have already entered the court system filing wrongful death lawsuits. So there's no statute of limitation problem. There's no problem with actually getting accountability. The problem is, there aren't enough files for them to prove conclusively that the damages should be paid by Zalman Shapiro, surviving NUMEC president, the Zionist Organization of America, or the Israeli government. Based on research conducted by myself and some other specialists, there is enough, we believe, there is enough information to get convictions, not of the acquiring organizations of Atlantic Richfield and Babcock and Wilcox, but actually going after the perpetrators of the smuggling, the people who created this entity to be what it was, a smuggling front. That means NUMEC's founders, the Israeli government, the Zionist Organization of America. But it's going to take more, pressure on classifying organizations that are hanging on to all of this information to get them to release it in time for people to actually get some satisfaction in court.
Well, that's exactly right. So for people out there who are interested in this story and do want to see some progress on it, A, how can they find out more about this? And B, what can they actually do to help with this campaign?
Well, we're launching a public campaign later this month. I'm not going to disclose the precise location, although people should be able to guess. It will be a public petition process with a high-profile launch to get the National Security Council, the FBI, the Justice Department, all of the National Archives, presidential libraries, and the NSA to finally release all of their classified documents about the NUMEC incident. Some documents are already in the pipeline of the interagency secure the ICECAP panel, which is a panel which has a good record of releasing documents that nobody thought could ever be released. They just recently forced the CIA to release the Jonathan Pollard damage assessment. So, you know, they're pretty tough. But the idea is to begin putting public pressure on some of these organizations that are sitting on all of these files, which never led to any formal criminal charges under the Atomic Energy Act, to at least allow individuals who have had severe health and property damage to go after the true perpetrators of their loss. And so you'll be seeing that in a few weeks. Just keep your Google automatic advisories focused on NUMMEC and Apollo, and you'll be seeing that. But the important thing is that, number one, people realize what actually happened. There's a fairly large population in the two communities, Parks Township and Apollo, Pennsylvania, who are mainly unaware of the smuggling connection to the plant that polluted their community. There's a $500 million U.S. Army Corps of Engineers cleanup that's going to be funded by U.S. taxpayers if nobody does anything about it, and a whole bunch of lawsuits directed at organizations that didn't even enter the picture until a decade after the smuggling front was acquired. And so there's an education process that needs to take place so that people can actually understand that the source of their loss, who actually caused their losses, and number two, to get them to actually ask the right agencies for redress. Now, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is somewhat aware of the problem. They recently held a meeting in Washington, D.C., about their cleanup efforts, which are taking place in Parks Township. Now, this was a nuclear dump for NUMMEC. There are actually FBI files of conversations between Zalman Shapiro, the plant president, and David Lowenthal, the smuggler who dreamed up a lot of this and backed him with facilities support. Talking about illegal storage and illegal dumping, and we're leaking all of this radiation and it's so many rads, blah blah blah. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has that information. They know the site that they have to clean up didn't follow the rules, that they may encounter things there that they never expected, and so they've held a meeting in Washington, D.C. And who do you think went to the meeting beyond the Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency? Well, it was the CIA, the Department of Homeland Security, the NSA. And so a lot of organizations went to that meeting. We still can't get the meeting minutes, but you don't have gun-toting Department of Homeland Security officials guarding just regular toxic dump sites in the United States. But you do have that in Parks Township. And so the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is in kind of a tight spot. They've got to clean up this facility. And the environmental activists and accountability activists in the surrounding region don't really have much motivation to go after Zalman Shapiro and the Israeli government and the Zionist Organization of America. They don't know anything about it. They've chosen the easy targets, Atlantic Richfield, Babcock, and Wilcox. And so there's kind of a process that needs to take place for people to actually get some real satisfaction in this issue. But I'm hopeful. Again, a lot of the files about some of the most egregious activity that took place at this smuggling front are now in the hands of a declassification review panel that's got a very good record. And so I think the public interest and public demands could actually have a real win here.
Well, we will certainly be keeping our eye on this. It's a developing story, obviously, and I'm looking for more action coming out on this later in the month, as you say. So I hope people will stay tuned to ermep.org as well for the latest information and press releases there. Grant Smith, a fascinating subject. I'm sure we could talk about this for hours, but let's leave it here for now, and hopefully we can have you back on for an update in the future. So Grant F. Smith, ermep.org, thank you again for your time today.
Thanks, James. Great to be on.